So if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Genesis, chapter 1, and we will get to that in just a second. So when I was growing up, every once in a while I would get sick and I would have to miss school. And when you're a kid and you miss school and you're actually sick and not faking sick, and you're allowed to, at least in my house, you were allowed to watch TV as long as you wanted to during the day, because no adult wants to, like, you know, pay attention to you. So, like, that's what you're gonna do. You're just gonna, like, they're gonna let you turn on the TV and do whatever. And I really resent the fact that I have to differentiate what it was like to watch TV when I was a kid versus what it's like to watch TV now. I feel like that's unfair and I shouldn't have to do it, but I do. So when I was, like, now, like, if this were to happen, you just binge whatever streaming service you've got, and you have limitless options at your fingertips. But at the time, in like the mid early 90s, the options were a lot more limited, and pretty much it was just like old sitcoms all day long that was on TV. And if you don't, like, if I wasn't like caught up on the story of all these old sitcoms, but the good news is that most old sitcoms have this device that they used to use, which was the opening theme song, because it used to be that. That sitcoms, because they knew that people were just gonna like start watching whenever, that every episode they had to like reset the story and tell you what had happened, like why this sitcom is the thing that it is. And so the opening theme song to most sitcoms from a specific era would start with basically like a summary of what had happened up until this point. So like if you were to watch like an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies, you would know like, oh, this guy struck oil and now he lives in California and it's crazy because he doesn't understand California. Or like Gilligan's Island, like there were these people, they were on a ship, the ship crashed, and not only would they tell you that the ship crashed, they would like literally like do a roll call of everybody who was on the boat. So like once the show starts, you're caught up, you are fully into the story. So like once the Harlem Globetrotters or like Batman shows up, you're like, this makes total sense, I totally get this. They were marooned on an island and now the Harlem Globetrotters are there, I have no questions. But the one that I loved was The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is probably the last like great sitcom. I said great with a capital G. The last truly great sitcom that would give you like the full catch up on its on the story of what happened. Because no matter when you watch an episode of the show, you would have to know, like, the one thing that's very important to understand the setup of the show is that this main character in the show is from West Philadelphia. In fact, that's where he was born and raised. And then one time he got in one little fight and his mom got scared and she told him he was gonna have to move in with his auntie and his uncle in Bel-Air. And then at that point you're like, okay, I'm fully caught up. I know everything I need to know to enjoy an episode of the show. But if you were to just watch the show without the theme song and having never seen it, you'd be like, this is very confusing. I don't understand why this person doesn't go with all these other people who all seem to be in the same family, but this one person has very different behavioral patterns than everybody else. What's going on here? But the theme song catches you up entirely. So here's where we're going with this, in case you were wondering. Before every episode, you are reminded of the beginning of the story, because the beginning of the story informs how you hear the rest of the story. Without the beginning, if you don't know how the story starts, the entire rest of the story can get quite confusing. But so basically, and this is why people like Ben, like, I know people now who, like, if they can't get a hold of the very first episode of a show, they will never watch it. Because how do I start without the beginning? Because we have this sort of innate sort of sense of, well, yeah, if you don't know the beginning of a thing, then how are you supposed to know what the thing is about? Because the beginning informs the entire rest of it. So a second ago, I said, turn in your Bible to Genesis 1. Maybe you grew up in a church where people start a sermon every single week with the phrase, turn in your Bible to. I want to invite you to go in your Bible to this particular passage. We do this every week. And perhaps you grew up in a situation or in a church style where every single week someone would open a Bible and randomly choose a passage and then look at it. And you would sort of look at it as if this one passage came out of a vacuum and it had no relation to anything else that had come before or after it. And so then at a certain point you start asking questions of like, yeah, but is this informed by anything else? Like, surely this is not just sort of like saran wrapped and just handed here, like with no prior like backstory or understanding of anything else. So the Bible has an opening scene. The Bible, if you will, the Bible has an opening theme song. And we often spend lots and lots of time looking at these isolated stories or passages without ever really asking questions about, is my interpretation of this story in any way connected to how the story began? Is it possible that there are certain elements of this story that I don't understand because I haven't really thought through where the story started? So we're going to start this series, and the series we're starting is about the book of Genesis. And I'm going to tell you now, this is going to take most of the year. We're going to spend most of 2020 in the book of Genesis. The last service, I said 2010. I don't know why. I'm still frustrated about it, but I did it. And I can't ignore it. I can't stand up here and pretend like I didn't. You wouldn't have known, but I had to tell you anyway, because it's been bothering me since then. But we're going to spend most of this year looking at the book of Genesis, because this is the book, like, if you ever started the new year and thought, like, this is the year I'm going to read the whole Bible, you got all the way through the book of Genesis and you gave up somewhere around Leviticus. But but the book of Genesis is where you start. This is like the opening scene. For some reason, this is where the whole thing begins. And so the question becomes, are there things that happen in the beginning that begin to inform the entire rest of the story? Is it possible that having a richer understanding of the book of Genesis will help us understand everything else that comes after Genesis, which is, in parentheses, everything that comes after? So we're gonna talk about the entire book of Genesis. So we're gonna start in Genesis chapter 1. So the first two chapters of Genesis are basically, again, the opening theme song. This is the attempt to frame the entire story and tell us what the whole story has been about all along. Without some sort of understanding of Genesis 1 and 2, I would argue there is a lack of understanding of what the whole rest of the story has been. We'll sort of demonstrate what that looks like as we go. So today, we're just going to look at Genesis chapter 1. So the first thing you need to know about Genesis chapter 1 is this is an ancient Hebrew poem. I once preached a sermon at another church. It may or may not have been a church where I worked right before we started this church. Who can say? But I was preaching a sermon at this particular church, and it was a Sunday morning. We were doing four services, like, back to back, and so this is, like, right in at the beginning of the first service. And I was preaching a sermon, and I mentioned Genesis 1, and I referred to Genesis 1 as a poem. And then, and I've told this story before, but I have to tell the story again because I just like telling the story. So whatever. So I get done with the sermon, and there's a guy who had been sitting in the sound booth, because I used to work at a church that had sound booths and not just Brian in the back with an iPad. And so this guy who had been in the sound booth, like, makes a beeline for me. He's very frustrated. You can see it all over his face. And he comes right over to me and he says, Rob, he's, like, so mad. He says, Rob, you cannot call Genesis 1 a poem. And I understand why, but I'm going to have to make him say why. And so I said, like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And he said, because if you tell people that Genesis 1 is a poem, then they'll believe that it's not true. And if they don't believe that Genesis 1 is true, they won't believe any of it's true, and everybody will leave here an atheist. And so, I mean, it sounds like I'm exaggerating. That is literally the case he made in to my face. So I said, so basically I was like, okay, I don't know about all that, but I don't know what to tell you, man. Genesis 1 is a poem. And he said, okay, listen, because he's going to help me out now. He said, I think what you mean to say is that Genesis 1 is poetic. And I said, that is correct. Genesis 1 is poetic because poems tend to be quite poetic. He did not love that. And because he was in the sound booth, he had to spend three more services listening to me call Genesis 1 a poem. And he wrote me a very strongly worded email the next day. So anyway, Genesis 1 is a poem. It's an ancient Hebrew poem. You know why? Because in the ancient Near East, when any culture or religion would begin to talk about the origin of where we came from, because there were lots of religions and lots of societies, and all of them were attempting to answer the same questions, primarily, who are we and where do we come from? Almost always, those stories came in the form of a poem. Genesis 1 is not unique. It is a creation poem from the ancient Near East. There's lots of them. In fact, we'll get to that in a second. I almost got ahead of myself. So Genesis 1 begins with a particular phrase, and perhaps you've heard it because you grew up in some sort of system that taught you Genesis 1. So Genesis 1, it begins, in the beginning, which is a great way to start, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, if you've heard this 100 times, it's become pretty vanilla, pretty bland. This is how the whole thing starts, right? You've heard this 100 times. Here's the thing, though. In its time, in the ancient Near East, this was actually a deeply subversive way to start a creation story. And here's why. Again, there were lots of other creation stories. There were lots of other societies. In fact, the dominant power at the time that this first emerges as a thing that begins to circulate, the dominant power at this time was the Babylonian Empire. And the Babylonian Empire had their own creation poem, and their creation poem is called the Enuma Elish. You can go to the library. It's very easy to find. So they have this creation poem called the Enuma Elish, and I'm going to go ahead and show you one artistic rendering of something from the Enuma Elish. I realize that most of us probably already have this in our living room, but whatever. It's a very... I'm just kidding. Nobody has this. So this is... This is a drawing of what were the two dominant gods in the ancient Babylonian narrative of the Enuma Elish. So this first one, this is the goddess Tiamat. I realize that you looked at her and like, oh, it looks like a typical drawing of a goddess, I guess. It's like a half dragon, half tiger thing. So anyway, this is the goddess Tiamat, and this is the god Marduk. So in the Enuma Elish, the narrative of this is before the earth was created, there were these gods. And there were lots of gods. And Tiamat was the ruler of all the gods. She was the main head god. And at a certain point, Marduk decides, I don't want to follow Tiamat. I should be in charge. And so Marduk gets a bunch of his other like god buddies and puts together a revolution. And he revolts against Tiamat. And there's this massive war that unfolds between the gods who are following Marduk and the gods who are following Tiamat. And eventually, Marduk wins and kills Tiamat. And so Marduk becomes the chief god of the Babylonians. And as a result, to sort of like, I guess, like send a message to the rest of the gods, like don't mess with me, what he does is we don't have any kids in here, this is gonna get a little gruesome. But what he does is he takes Tiamat's body and he cuts it in half. And what accidentally happens with the remains of Tiamat's like severed carcass? Nope, corpse. I tried to say corpse and carcass at the same time, totally messed it up. This is life in 2010, everybody. So Marduk like cuts her carcass in half, and half of her carcass becomes the skies or the heavens, and the other half of the carcass becomes the earth or the ground. And so the idea here is that what was created was not created by one benevolent, intentional god. It was there was a war, and the main god who lost the war, which means the weaker, more evil god, is basically all things have come from the flesh of a weak, evil, defeated god. So that's where the heavens and the earth came. And then also, by the way, Tiamat had a lover named Kingu, and Marduk killed Kingu and spilled his blood on the ground. And when Marduk spills Kingu's blood on the ground, he accidentally created people with the blood. Because, you know, we've all seen this kind of thing happen before. So the blood is spilled on the ground. People emerge as if to say, like, oh, whoops, we didn't mean to do that, but now they're here, so what are we going to do about this? So the belief was that the main god, in the Babylonian narrative, the main god that we all revere and worship sees all of creation as being like the remnants of his dead enemies. So if that is how the main god views everything, then how, like, what are the main god's emotional connections to you as a person? You know what I'm saying? So like the idea here is that the gods hate all of creation because all of creation reminds them of their vanquished enemies. So this is the narrative that is dominant at this time. So if you, as an ancient Hebrew citizen of this world, if you receive a poem about how all the things got started, and the poem begins, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There's no bloodshed, there's no war, there's no, like, this is a God that we hate, and so, like, we're just gonna kill her. Like, there's none of that. It's just, in the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth. Already, like, from the jump, this poem is deeply subversive, like pushing back against the dominant narrative of the time. And we're just in verse one. So the dominant story about and creation poems were generally not about, first of all, not about one god, but about several. And then in the Babylonian creation story, the Enuma Elish, there was, again, this sort of notion of the gods hate everything that was created. Like, it wasn't intentional, it was an accident, and they're like everything is sort of like without inherent value. So the Babylonian origin story of all creation establishes a world in which, first of all, human beings are created out of the carcass of a weak and evil god, which causes Marduk and the other gods to look at humanity with contempt and the rest of creation. And then two, the creation of the heavens and the earth were basically an accident. Like, everything is accidental in this ancient narrative. So when the Bible opens with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, it totally flies in the face of these other dominant traditions of the time. It says something unique about God and humanity and the world around us. So the dominant question here is, what is this poem trying to say? And in what ways is this a counter message against what we've already heard? So to understand fully what is going on and what the counter message is, we're gonna have to read the whole thing, all through Genesis 1. And I know you're thinking, like, oh good, I was really hoping we would read all of Genesis 1. So we'll do it quickly and we'll kind of start and stop as we go. But in order to sort of see kind of the larger patterns of what's going on here, it's helpful to just sort of look at all of it. So we'll just go. So in Genesis, this is on the back of your bulletin, by the way, if you need to look at it. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And then God said, let there be light, and there was light. Which, by the way, this is a very different narrative. Like, when God speaks, the thing that God speaks becomes, like, comes into existence. This is very different than war and bloodshed, is it not? This is one God who doesn't create through violence. This is a God who creates through speech. So it says, and then in verse 4, it says, God saw that the light was good. Now, this word is very important here. So if you are following along and you have a pen, feel free to underline the word good every time it shows up, because it's going to show up a lot. So it says, God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning the first day. Now, people tend to get really hung up, like, this language of the first day. Like, people get really hung up on, like, the day, the whole day notion of the whole thing. Like, was this a literal 6 days, or is this a metaphorical 6 days? For those of you who, like this needs to be a literal 6 days, like, I'm not here to take that away from you. But I will say, that's not really what the poem is about. Like, that's, if that's the thing that bothers you, if you're like, this, here's why the Bible is ridiculous, because all this couldn't have happened in 6 days. Yeah, but that's not really, it's a poem. Again, like, the point is not, like, how long this goes. The point of the days is not, like, a specific length of time, which, by the way, the sun doesn't show up till day 4, which, if you're using the sun to determine the length of a day, like, that's tricky. The point of the days is not, like, the exact specific length of time. The point of the days is to show that there is an order. There is intentionality. This happens, and then there's a break. This happens, and then there's a break. There's a divide in how things are going. This is very, very different. Because if you're living in a world where the dominant narrative is about bloodshed and chaos, and everything happens by accident, the purpose of the day structure is a way of saying none of this was an accident. All of this was done with a certain sense of care and intentionality. That's the point of this. The question of, like, how long is the day, and, like, or all those kinds of, that's the least interesting question about this poem. So then in verse 6, it says, and God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was so. God called the vault sky, and there was evening and there was morning the second day. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let the dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plant and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seeds according to their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kind. God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the third day. Then God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate day from night, and let them serve as signs to mark sacred times, the days and the years. And let there be lights in the vault of the sky that give light to the earth. So there's the sun. Here comes the sun. And it says, and it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was, there it is again, good. And there was evening and there was morning the fourth day. And God said, let the waters teem with living creatures, let the birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and it moves about in it according to their kind, every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful, which blessed, by the way, that's also a deeply subversive word in this context. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kind, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, the wild animals according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kind, the livestock according to their kind, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in God's own image. In the image of God, God created them. Male and female, God created them. Which, by the way, there's one way to tell this story, that is all of humanity comes from the weaker, more evil gods. But there's a whole other way of telling the story that says human beings are made in the image of God. This is, again, deeply subversive. This changes the whole story. So then in verse 28, it says, God blessed them. and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. You see how different this is from what we already saw from the Babylonian narrative. If you grew up in a system in which this is the dominant story, in which the gods go to war and the gods hate us because we remind them of their dead enemies, that's a very different story than the one that we just read. And by the way, like the occurrence of the days and also the occurrence of the word good, this, if we're using sort of like the poetry format, this is sort of like the downbeat. This is like the bass note. This sort of goes through the whole thing of like, this happens and God saw that it was good. This happens and God saw that it was good. Why is that important? Because the places where it says God declares that something is good tell us that there is this ongoing affirmation to everything that's being created. Everything that's being created, it's not an accident, and it's not something that the gods hate. It is created intentionally, and it is created with this internal, intrinsic sense of it's good. There is this ongoing affirmation of everything that gets created. And then in verse 28, it says God blesses humanity, which again is very different than what you find in the Babylonian story. And so it says God blesses humanity and tells humans to go bless everything else. Because the purpose of human beings in the Babylonian narrative is to try to not make the gods so angry that the gods want to kill us all. Because if the gods already hate you, you're already on super thin ice. So everything we do has to like keep the gods happy. So do whatever you can to keep the gods happy, even if it means killing your neighbor. But in the Genesis narrative, it's you are blessed. And so now you go bless everything else. This is all like an upside down, like every single thing about the Enuma Elish is turned upside down in Genesis 1. So everything is woven together. Everything is created with this internal, intrinsic sense of, and it was good, and it matters. There is an intrinsic value to all of this. The Hebrew word we would use for this, and this is not gonna, if you've been around for a while, this is not gonna surprise you at all. The Hebrew word for this state of being is the word shalom. We tend to talk about shalom in terms of like it's just peace, like in terms of just like an absence of conflict, but shalom is way more interesting than that. Shalom is the idea that at its core, everything that was created has value, and everything that was created is at its center made with a sense of goodness and purpose and intentionality. This is according to the theology of Radiohead, this is everything in its right place. This is the way things are meant to be. So when we talk about shalom, what we're saying is when things originally were created, there was the sense of this is good. This is the way it was meant to be. Everything has a sense of peace and goodness and love and wholeness to it that perhaps don't look the way we expect things to look today. So the entire created order is made in such a way that everything exists as it was meant to be. And we'll talk more about this next week a little bit, but we need to sort of get into what are we talking about when we talk about shalom. So there are, in Genesis 1 and also in Genesis 2, but we're mostly focusing just on Genesis 1 today, but in Genesis 1 and 2, there are four quadrants of shalom. So there are four ways that shalom kind of shows up that kind of inform the entire rest of the story. So first of all, there is a sense of shalom between humanity and God. The arrow points up because I don't know how else to do it. But so there is this sense of shalom between humanity and our creator. We are told at the beginning of the whole thing that humanity is created with the image of God like embedded inside of it. There is in Latin, the term here is the Imago Dei. And what this means is you have never met a person who does not somewhere inside of their being possess within them the image of God. There is an inherent value to humanity. There are other narratives that suggest that our value comes from what we do, and that our value comes from how we please the gods at a certain level. This narrative says, when you were created, you were given value. Just by the fact that you exist gives you value. That makes you matter. So there is this sort of ongoing shalom, this understanding that I have value. I was created on purpose, and there is value to my life, and I don't have to prove it to anybody. I just am. The fact of my own existence is in and of itself the image of God. So there is a reflection. There's some divine spark that we carry within us. So the first like quadrant of Shalom is there is some sort of connection between us and the divine that suggests that there is value inside of every human, whether we recognize it or not. So there's that, but then also there is, and we'll see this more in the second chapter next week, but there is a sense of Shalom between people. So there's like this interrelated, and we don't really see this in Genesis 1. This shows up more in Genesis 2. In Genesis 2:18, it's a little further on. In verse 25, it says that there are these two people in the story, and that the two people are naked and they feel no shame. And we tend to take that out like at its most literal face value, like, oh, they just have not figured out clothes yet. But what it really is the most important phrase there is not naked. The most important phrase there is they felt no shame. Because what that suggests is that in the original sort of vision of how all things were supposed to be, there was supposed to be this unbroken connection between human beings. That this impulse towards shame and fear and anxiety, those aren't part of the original story. A sense of disconnection is not how it was supposed to go. So if you have ever felt like there was someone that you were close to, and then at a certain point, there was a tear in that relationship. There was a breaking of some sort. And now you're not as close. And now you're losing sleep because you're worried about what that person thinks. And you feel like it's been way too long since we just like talked and really connected. And you feel like the longer it goes, the further and further apart you feel. That anxiety, that feeling of like, maybe this isn't the way it's supposed to be. I would argue that comes from this deep sense of, yeah, because you were created for shalom. Like you were created to have connection. You were created to have close relationships with people. And when something feels broken or torn, there is a disruption in that. That's not the way it was supposed to be. And again, we'll talk more about this as we get further into Genesis 2 next week. But there's this sort of embedded sense of, oh, the way it was supposed to be is no shame. The way it was supposed to be was like this longing to connect with other people, that we would have close friendships and that we would have people in our life that we feel open to and connected with in some real, it's like soul level kind of way. So there's that. And then the third quadrant of Shalom, each of these could be its own sermon series, so I'm going really fast. But the third quadrant of Shalom is, this is the ground. It's not, I don't know what it looks like, but it's supposed to be the ground. Is Shalom between humanity and the rest of creation and the earth. Because the thing is, maybe you grew up in a tradition, as I did, that suggests that the value of the earth and the value of livestock and the value of everything that isn't human beings, the value of that is only defined by how useful it is to human beings. Are you with me? So like the idea that creation in and of itself is a good thing, with or without humans, is for some of us a hard thing to hear because we didn't grow up with that. But it's embedded in this poem. Because what it says, one of the things that shows up, first of all, leading up, like humans don't show up till way late in the story, but everything up until that point is already being said to be good, right? So the whole thing was good long before human beings got there. And then when human beings do show up, what are we told? We're told, go, and it says subdue and rule over, which by the way does not mean exploit and strip and destroy. What that does mean is go and treat the rest of creation as God has treated you. And go and treat creation with a sense of goodness and gratitude and a sense of stewardship over what we have been given like permission to use to like create more life. So we were told at the beginning of this whole thing that creation is good and that our job was to interact with creation as if it were good. So if you're looking around the world right now and you're a little bit bothered by how casually we abuse the earth, and there, like the language and the the dismissive way that we talk about the well-being of the planet is really sort of starting to bother you a lot. Why is that? I would argue that's not just because you're like too sensitive to those kinds of things. I would argue that is because you still, somewhere deep inside of you, there is this embedded notion that we were made for shalom with our environment. And then when shalom is disrupted, something is wrong with that. We had a sick kid in our house this last week, which is never fun. My 7-year-old daughter was sick for several days. And the thing about my daughter is if she goes longer than a whole day without going outside, she starts to kind of lose it a little bit. Like it's a dark place she goes to. So she couldn't go outside because she was so sick. And so there was one point where I had to wrap her up in a blanket and just take her outside and like sit on the porch with her for 30 minutes because like time spent out of the sun, like any day where you don't see the sun is a bad day in her eyes. So why? Maybe it's just because being sick is terrible and you just like long for some semblance of like outside and normalness. But also, what if it's that there is this inside of her somewhere, there is this sense of, I should be outside. Like, I wonder if there's this sense of like, I should be in some way connecting with something larger than what's inside my house, you know? So what this tells us, this whole idea in Genesis 1 of shalom with creation is, yeah, we were created to have a healthy, respectful, generative, sustainable relationship with our environment, that's part of shalom. And when you sense that there's something wrong with that, that's not just you being a tree hugger, which by the way, like why is tree hugger a bad thing? Like hug trees, you know what I mean? Trees are great. Like all the way from like Genesis 1, we're told trees are good. Like have they fondness towards trees? They give us oxygen. So there is, but the idea of being an environmental, like being concerned about the environment has been like framed in a lot of circles as being a bad thing. And I would argue like, no, like that's like one of the oldest things that we have is the notion that the earth is good and that our relationship with it is supposed to be reflective of a sense of shalom and purpose. So that's the third of the four quadrants. And then the fourth one is, I don't know exactly how to say this, but just sort of like an internal sense of shalom, like an inward sense of wholeness and put back togetherness. And this sort of goes back to the Genesis 2 thing about like feeling no shame, which is at a certain point, we learned that we should feel anxious about things, that we should feel shame about things, that we should should internalize pain and carry it with us in lots of really, really unhealthy, hurtful kinds of ways. And so maybe you're an adult now and you were handed some things as a kid and the things that you were handed have really kind of done a number on you. And now you're sort of walking through the earth with this sense of like your soul feels like it's broken in 1,000 pieces or you have like this really heavy baggage that you just have to carry with you everywhere. And maybe what this notion of shalom is trying to communicate with us is maybe it's not supposed to be that way. And so maybe this inner sense of wholeness and health, like emotional and mental health, maybe these are really important conversations to have because what we're pursuing here is shalom. We're pursuing like everything in its right place, everything being put back together. And sometimes that starts from the inside. So maybe we look at this and we think like, oh, okay, so if this is the way it was supposed to be, then that explains all of my anxiety and frustration with how things are going. Because a lot of times when we talk about how things aren't supposed to be, what we're talking about is a lack of shalom. So in fact, I would argue every sermon I've ever preached has in some way been informed by one, if not all of these four quadrants. Because what we're talking, like the whole narrative of the scripture is about this. It's about the restoration and the renewal of shalom. It's about everything being put back together as it was originally meant to be. So again, this is sort of like the opening theme song of the whole thing. The whole thing is informed by intentionality and goodness and grace and love and shalom. The whole thing is informed by this is a beautiful, good thing that has been created, and you are a part of that, just by the way. So a couple of observations about this. One is that in Genesis 1, heaven and earth are the same place. A lot of times we talk about sort of like this disembodied, like, okay, we're here, but this place is bad. And so one day we'll die and we'll go to some other place and that place will be good. But that's not in this story, that's not how things are. How things are here is everything is good, like right out of the gate. Everything begins good. So in this story, it isn't like this disembodied, separated, dualistic way of like, there's one space that's bad and another space that's good. Like, no, the whole thing is good. In the original creation, the whole thing is the way it was meant to be. So that's the first observation. The second observation I would make is that in Genesis 1, being a human is a good thing. Now again, maybe you grew up in a system that begins, like the entire premise of the theology of the system is, you know, you're just a sinner and you're bad and God really hates you. But good news, God has a son named Jesus who likes you. So Jesus's job is to convince God to hate you a lot less than God does. And so Jesus is pretty cool about that kind of stuff. And so then, so Jesus will trick God into liking you so then you don't have to like suffer forever. That's, for a lot of us, that's what we were given. And it begins with this very like, you are broken, you are messed up, you are the worst. That is, but here's the thing, that's not Genesis 1. That does not show up in this narrative. That doesn't show up for several more chapters, as it turns out. That actually comes from a different narrative. Are you with me? Like, we borrowed that from somebody else's story, and we just kept it. This notion that being a human being is a bad thing. No, in Genesis 1, being a human is a good thing. Being a human means being an image bearer of God. Being a human means that you have a divine spark within you and that you are connected to something much, much bigger than yourself. So, in fact, Daniel Schroyer, who has preached here, has written a book called Original Blessing, which I love and I highly recommend it. But in Daniel Schroyer's book, one of the things that she sort of deals with is, like, we need to get away from this whole idea of, like, the notion of original sin, because original sin suggests that the whole thing started from a place of flawed brokenness. But the thing is, that, again, that's not a Genesis 1 problem. That shows up, again, it shows up later, but it's not original. If we're talking about original, if we're talking about where things begins, that's not there. What we start with is what she refers to as original blessing. The whole thing begins from a place of goodness and blessing and shalom. So she writes in her book, Original Blessing, she writes, original blessing reminds us that God calls us good and beloved before we are anything else. Sin is not at the heart of our nature. Blessing is. Then she goes on and writes, from our origin of goodness, we can grow into and live into the goodness God intends for us. So original blessing isn't just a state of being, but also a process of being. We could say blessing is and blessing unfolds. In other words, our job is to participate in a story that is not about just feeling really bad about ourselves and trying not to mess up so much and trying not to make the gods angry. That the whole story is about you are embedded with goodness and shalom and imago Dei, and your job is to continue to develop and unfold that story. So, Genesis 1 is a reminder of where we started and the kind of story we are participating in. It is an invitation to return to a place of goodness and shalom. It is an invitation to see ourselves as worthy of love and participants in a story that is about, at its core, love and blessing and goodness. So, may you see yourself as an original recipient of love and shalom. If you have internalized this narrative of, like, you are bad at your core and there is no value in you, like, may you let that go. And may you see, like, no, the whole thing starts with an internal imago Dei. It starts with a divine spark. You are good. You are loved. You are worthy of love. So may you participate in a story that is at its heart about the renewal and embrace of shalom in all of its forms. Let me pray for us. God, we thank you for this beautiful subversive message that we are invited to participate in a story that is about the renewal of all things. And for those of us who struggle to see ourselves as loved or worthy of love, may we heal from whatever wound caused that. May we find that our value comes from simply the fact that we exist, that there is an inherent goodness embedded in each of us. May we seek shalom in the broken relationships. May we pursue healthy relationships, and may we be healthy within them. May we find that we are invited to participate in a story that is about shalom as it regards all the rest of creation. And may we find that we are on a journey of internal healing and restoration. May we find that sometimes shalom begins on the inside. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.